As Dan mentioned, we're in Proverbs. This is the second week, and you'll be hearing from a variety of us this summer. So let me thank you in advance to adjusting your ears to different perspectives and different styles. And before we look at a collection of Proverbs from chapter 16, I want to take a few minutes to continue the introduction that Scott began last week. I have to say, for me, this preaching assignment was a significant challenge. I just haven't spent that much time in Proverbs over the years, nor have I heard them taught that often. Most frequently, Eric Soderberg did give a wonderful sermon from Proverbs last summer during our series on kingdom work. As I was reflecting on my neglect, a few things came to mind. First, for my read through the Bible program last year, I would often listen to the day's passages in my car on the way to work. I have a really long commute. And let me tell you, this works great for biblical narrative. It also kind of works for the Psalms and the New Testament letters. But if it works at all for Proverbs, it's just the first nine chapters. After that, saying after saying melt together, and you just can't begin to make sense of them. Soon your mental jug overflows and they all just seem to go down the drain. If you're familiar with the old I Love Lucy show, it's like Lucy and Ethel trying to wrap chocolates on the assembly line. You just can't take them in that fast. Second, I also realize that I should actually have more interest than I do, because I like to create my own proverb-like sayings to help me make sense of my own life. I don't have anywhere near as many as Andy Burnham, but I do have a few. Those of you who know me probably have heard too many times that I'm one dumpster away from total bliss. Or for fixing computer problems, I came up with Homeland's first law of troubleshooting. It's always the cable. When my kids started to drive, I'd tell them nothing good happens after midnight. A few others, deferred maintenance is a way of life. 95% of any plumbing repair is removing the old fixture. My grandfather had some that I recall. Before every meal, without fail, as if he was telling it for the first time, he'd say, "You know, hunger is a gift from God. That's why we should always thank him for our food." He'd also say, "There's a place for everything, and keep everything in its place." My mother, when trying to turn left on a busy street, would simply sigh and say, "He who hesitates is lost." I think we can all relate to that one. Rest assured now, I don't confuse these with the inspired sayings we find in Proverbs. But there's something about them that I do find intriguing. I'm pretty sure that if you put a dumpster in my front yard and I filled it up next week, that my longing for peace and tranquility would not be fulfilled. We all know that at least once there was a computer problem unrelated to a bad cable. A lot of good things do actually happen after midnight, most notably for many of us, the birth of our children. So what am I trying to communicate in these short, pithy sayings? It's not the absolute, literal meaning of the words always holding true, but something more nuanced. I'm saying that my possessions are starting to own me and not the other way around. I'm saying that when faced with a problem, computer or otherwise, I all too often overlook the obvious. I'm saying that there's no real upside for a teenager to be out and about after midnight. I'm saying that life's a little more complicated and that we need to think. And this isn't my idea, of course. It's captured beautifully in the Proverbs. We all need to think because life isn't black and white. Different times and situations call for different actions and responses. One size doesn't fit all. You can't fit a square peg in a round hole. I tried to see how many of these kind of sayings I could fit in this morning. So I read a fascinating article in the website called The New Atlantis about Nobel Prize winning physicist Richard Feynman. When he was young, he earned pocket change by fixing radios for his neighbors. The article describes one of his repairs. One radio that started up with a tremendous roar and wobble before calming itself and playing right required more than the usual consideration. The customer saw Feynman walking back and forth instead of taking the radio apart right away, and he told the kid that he must not know what he was doing. The imperturbable boy answered, "I'm thinking." Feynman thought some more, then proceeded to reverse the order of the tubes, and the radio played perfectly. The skeptic was now a true believer. As Feynman tells the story, the neighbor then got me other jobs and kept telling everybody what a tremendous genius I was, saying, "He fixes radios by thinking." The whole idea of thinking to fix a radio. A little boy stops and thinks and figures out how to do it. He never thought that was possible. So I realize that I lack Feynman's disciplined thinking when I read the Proverbs. I can't disassemble them right away, so I give up. The meaning or application's not immediately obvious, so I move on to the next thing. It seldom dawns on me that I must actually stop and think. What a concept. We don't seem to have much time for thinking nowadays. If it's not on the first page of a Google search, then we assume the answer isn't worth pursuing. But Proverbs is all about the lifelong process of learning to live life skillfully as God intended. It's not an effortless endeavor. I was listening to an old recorded lecture by Ed Clowney of Westminster Seminary, and he recalled what his colleague Tom Nicholas used to say. He says, "We know about the milk of the word, we know about the meat of the word. Well, Proverbs are the hard candy of the word. You've got to put one under your tongue and suck on it a while to get anything out of it." And I'm finding that to be true. The other barrier we face that I alluded to earlier is that Proverbs, especially the middle section, does not appear to tell a story. And stories are the preferred method in our culture of communicating ideas. We rightly consider the entire Bible to tell a story of God's creation and then his redemption of that creation. We spent an entire year going through that story a few years ago. A preacher can't do justice to a passage in the Old Testament without understanding where it fits in the grand story. And even the long, to us tedious, legal codes in Leviticus have a place in the story in a particular time. Perhaps that's why, if we know anything at all about Proverbs, it's the first 9 chapters and chapter 31. Those chapters come the closest to telling a story. And in a sense, I think they do provide a framework of sorts that can help us navigate through the book. Scott taught last week the central theme of Proverbs is that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The word used for God in most of the book of Proverbs is Yahweh, I am, the one he gave to Moses, the one Jesus applied multiple times to himself in the Gospel of John. It's not the generic term for God, but rather his personal name. This means that wisdom is intimately tied to relationship. We can't be wise in isolation. So Proverbs begins in the home with lessons to a son from his father and mother. I think we can all picture this setting quite easily. It's clear from the lessons that the son is on the verge of adulthood. And the very first lesson after the opening prologue is a severe warning about being careful with whom you run. Dave Bland, whose book Proverbs and the Formation of Character I found very helpful, says this first lecture is meant to get the youth's attention. Even the smallest of bad choices can lead to dire consequences. Stay far from those whose feet run to evil and who make haste to shed blood. That's Proverbs 1:16. Many of us know people who have fallen in with the wrong crowd early in their adult years, only to have the course of their lives change forever. Maybe something similar happened to you. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that the rise of street gangs today is one of the most severe threats to our nation's stability and well-being. A civilization whose next generation trains itself on the streets will cease to be civilized. Thus, it's so important to parent not just our own children, but those whose parents aren't in the picture. In this very first lesson, the father and mother warn the son that it's not that difficult to really make a mess of your life. We all need someone to tell us this when we're young, especially if our mother and father aren't around. The focus on the son in the first 9 chapters should not deter us from applying these lessons to our sons and daughters. The original cultural context is a patriarchal society. Some scholars think that it's possible that the daughters at that time were far less likely to depart from the family tradition, and so therefore did not need such direct exhortation. However, since the mother is involved in the training together with the father, it's clear she has also been instructed in wisdom at some point in her life. Furthermore, wisdom calls to everyone, not just the young, but the old. Whoever is simple, whoever lacks sense, turn in here and eat wisdom's bread and drink her wine. It's Proverbs 9, 4 through 5. She gives instruction to a wise man so that he will be wiser still. Proverbs 9, 9. It's a more elegant way of saying that in fact you can teach an old dog new tricks, at least a wise old dog. For those of us committed to following Jesus faithfully, we can never say we are too set in our ways, that we're unable to change. If we do, we've either given up or are too prideful, or maybe both. Instead, forgetting what lies behind, we press on toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. So these first 9 chapters give us a picture of moral instruction in the home. A father and mother diligently teaching their son in the ways of wisdom. The book concludes with chapters 30 and 31, 2 chapters distinct from those that preceded. I won't go into the details of that now. But many of us are familiar with a virtuous woman found at the end of chapter 31, beginning in verse 10. This woman is the culmination of the book. Dave Bland writes, "What is portrayed is a lifetime of discipline, instruction, hard work, and fearing God that is condensed into a single poem." Furthermore, he writes that after reading through King Solomon's collection, and then those collected by King Hezekiah, and then those from King Lemuel, we might expect that the ultimate paradigm of wisdom would be a king or a well-known sage. Surprisingly, he writes, whom they present is an ordinary person. They put forward an unknown woman of wisdom. This means, of course, that Proverbs 31 is not just for women. Both men and women are called to pursue the character she has attained in her God-centered community. That is, we are all to develop the qualities of trust, service, prudence, discipline, generosity, courage, hard work, and most importantly, the fear of the Lord. Listen to verses 25 and 26 of chapter 31. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she smiles at the future. She opens her mouth in wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. Who wouldn't want that said about them, man or woman? So we see then that there's a kind of story built into Proverbs, and this gives us a little bit of a framework to mentally place the middle chapters of 10 through 29. These are my flyover chapters, my clean pages in Proverbs. Scholars refer to them as the sentence literature, and I think we can see why that maybe doesn't whet our appetite for further investigation. But you know, that label's actually appropriate. I think it was Cervantes who said that a proverb is a short sentence based on long experience. And that's exactly what you get starting in chapter 10. Short sentence after short sentence. Almost all of these proverbs are only 2 lines long. And they fill in the gap between the adolescent son and the wise woman at the end. This is the material to be mastered in life. And they need to be considered as a whole because, as I mentioned, different situations call for different responses. It has been said that he who knows one proverb knows none. You can't use the one proverb as the hammer to which everything else looks like a nail. You'll hurt somebody. In the original Hebrew, the proverbs are much shorter than in our English translations, I believe just 7 or 8 syllables. This made them much easier to remember. I was thinking about that. Golfers have a saying on the putting green, never up, never in, which is short and memorable. It means, if you don't strike the ball at least as hard as the distance it is from the hole, it has no chance at all of going in. And sometimes our English translations of the proverbs seem to be very far from the brevity of never up, never in, and closer to that expanded explanation. So we have to work that much harder to commit them to memory. And I struggle with that. Let me conclude the overview now with just a brief word about biblical poetry. This is a key reason why thinking is important when we read the Proverbs. If we read quickly, it might seem that the second line just restates the first. Or many Proverbs are what are called antithetical Proverbs. They're the opposite. And we just think the second line is just the exact opposite of the first. But close examination reveals that there's much more going on there. You need to look for heightened emphasis, maybe a contrast in the verbs used, or maybe a singular subject versus a plural one. We need to look for all kinds of things. And there's much more that can be said about this by people much more capable than I, but that'll wait for the future. But please consider that these sentence proverbs may be one of the easiest ways of introducing regular family devotions or of having more meaningful conversations with your friends. Imagine sitting down to dinner and asking everyone to compare their day to Proverbs 15:1. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. That could be a long conversation. Perhaps at Thanksgiving, reflect on Proverbs 15:17. Better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a fattened ox and hatred with it. So there are hundreds of these sentence proverbs. We won't readily exhaust the supply. So I want to look now at Proverbs 16:1-9. These are considered a unit. And in addition to Dave Bland's book, Dr. Bruce Walke's lecture on this chapter at biblicaltraining.org was really helpful to me. There's actually a whole series of lectures from Dr. Walke at no cost. These 9 verses are at the start of the second section of Solomon's collection that runs from chapter 10 through 22:16. So they're almost exactly in the middle of that section. The preceding 6 chapters have been primarily concerned with human actions. But now we see that the focus shifts. Bland says that the unifying theme of all 9 of these verses is a fundamental belief in the active presence of God. Verses 1 through 3 describe God's sovereignty. Verses 5 through 8, his justice. Verse 4 links the 2 sections together. And verse 9 looks back to the first 3 verses. We live really in a culture of extremes. On the one hand, there's just so much tragedy, anger, pain and sorrow around us, that it's so easy to get the impression that life is completely random and out of control. Seems there's nothing we, or God for that matter, can do about it. Bad things just happen to good people, period. But the other extreme are those weaned on Henley's poem, Invictus, the masters of their fates, the captains of their souls. For these unconquerable ones, there's no problem that cannot be solved with some nifty code and enough computing power. The Tower of Babel will soon be rebuilt, on Mars maybe. However, the first 9 verses of Proverbs 16 show us the divine perspective, one that's neither utter despair nor supreme overconfidence. And all but one of the Proverbs, this is how you know they go together, all but one, verse 8, include the Lord. And again, that's his personal, relational name. It's the name that signifies his desire to know us and for us to be in his presence. To borrow from Francis Schaeffer, he is there and he is not silent. As I read each proverb, I'm just going to pause briefly, try to avoid that overflow effect before I make any comments. Hopefully this will let them sink in just a little bit more. It also encourage us to set aside each week through this series some time to reflect on the Proverbs individually. You really just can't take them in quickly. See how God is speaking to you through them. Proverbs 16:1. The plans of the heart belong to man, but the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. So we actually do have a short, pithy version of this in English. It's man proposes, but God disposes. Now, the proverb doesn't teach that planning is wrong. We are stewards of God's creation, charged with its care. And that takes planning, among many other things. A preacher prepares diligently, but prays even more earnestly that it is God who will speak. And that's never more true than this morning. But our plans always require our humility. In Numbers, if you recall, the prophet Balaam found out the hard way. Three times he tried to curse God's people, and three times blessings came out. The last word, they say, always belongs to the Lord. James 4:15 addresses those who think otherwise. This is what James writes. We ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. In the book of Acts, the apostle Paul and his companions attempted to go into Bithynia, but the Spirit of Jesus did not allow them. Karen McCormick spoke last August about how to respond when your plans are disrupted in her excellent sermon titled Direction for Detours. So I'd encourage you to revisit that if you can. We hold all our plans loosely. We demonstrate the attitude of Jesus. Not my will, but thy will be done. So think about the events in your own life that have not gone as you've planned. Ask yourself if you can see how the Lord has answered in those cases. Proverbs 16:2. All the ways of a man are pure in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the spirit. If you're like me, you like to think that you're right. You have a hard time admitting when you're wrong. You think you're totally objective. But none of us are. None of us have completely pure motives. Try as we might, each one of us fails to see the log in our own eye. But the Lord weighs the spirit. He sees what no one else can see. You know, we can't fool God. We can't fake it till we make it. And it's interesting, the word for spirit here is the word that literally means wind. So it means God weighs the wind. He weighs the unweighable. And this word triggers a memory in me of King Belshazzar in Daniel 5. Though he knew how God had humbled Nebuchadnezzar, he did not humble himself. Instead, Daniel tells him that he lifted up himself against the Lord of heaven. He did not honor the God in whose hand was his breath. And so Daniel interprets the handwriting on the wall for Belshazzar. His days were numbered. His kingdom would be divided. He had been weighed in the balances and found wanting. What a devastating summary of an arrogant king's life. What a devastating summary of anyone's life. You have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. How many of our political leaders, our titans of business, our celebrities today ponder these words? How many of us ordinary folk? When you see your handwriting on the wall, what does it say? And here's the reassurance that I found in Psalm 139. David prays, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts, and see if there be any hurtful way in me, and lead me in the everlasting way. I think that's why I've been getting so emotional coming to church each week, is sort of the reality of God's kingdom just overwhelms all the little stuff I've been worried about through the preceding week. I want to just take that with me always. Proverbs 16:3. Commit your work to the Lord, and your plans will be established. Dr. Walke says, because we can't trust our motives to be pure, we have to live by faith. We submit everything we do to the Lord. This proverb reminds me of what Jesus said on the Sermon on the Mount. Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and all these things will be added to you. The order is the same. Commit your work to the Lord. Then your plans will be established. And the Lord will separate the wheat from the chaff, preserving only what has lasting value. Proverbs 16:4. The Lord has made everything for its purpose, even the wicked for the day of trouble. So the first line of the proverb looks back to the previous three verses, and it's linked by the word purpose. It's actually the same word as answer in verse 1. And I think when you put these together, it's Proverbs' short, cryptic way of saying what Paul's talking about in Romans 8:28. We know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. It's what Joseph was telling his brothers after Jacob died. You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. This line's tremendously reassuring, if not always easy to accept. There's no mistakes in God's economy. Whatever our circumstances, whatever our deficiencies, whatever our defects, whatever our sins, each one of us has been made by God for his good purposes. There are no throwaway people, no throwaway lives. Now the second line of verse 4 looks forward to verses 5 through 8, the justice of God. It's important to note it's not a proof text that suggests some were created with no other possible destiny but damnation. Rather, it's a sobering reminder that there will be a day of reckoning. There will be judgment by a righteous judge. Those who choose poorly choose trouble, which leads to the next verse. Proverbs 16:5. Everyone who is arrogant in heart is an abomination to the Lord. Be assured he will not go unpunished. Our region is filled with engineers, people who solve problems. I pretend to be one, don't solve that many problems. But the way you really solve a problem is to identify its root cause. And pride is the ultimate root cause. Pride is the condition of each human heart that says, my will, not thy will. Pride insists that we can dismiss God, that he's unnecessary. It's the ultimate denial of reality. It's the ostrich with its head perpetually in the sand. And that's why it's an abomination to the Lord. It's just not true. Our pride is not a reflection of reality. And it will not last. Proverbs 16:6. By steadfast love and faithfulness, iniquity is atoned for. And by the fear of the Lord, one turns away from evil. Of all the walks that I wish I could have taken, the road to Emmaus is at the top of the list. This is where Jesus is explaining to the two travelers how all the scriptures pointed to him. And I have to wonder, did he read this proverb to them? Here's the antidote for our pride. Here is where we see the true justice of God, doing for us by his own loyal love and faithfulness what we could not do for ourselves. Here is the gospel in Proverbs. Jesus is the one who perfectly lived Proverbs 16:6. In 2 Corinthians, Paul writes, "For our sake he made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God." Just a few verses before that, he had written, "Knowing the fear of the Lord, we persuade others." He wrote, "The love of Christ controls us." He wrote, "He died for all that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but for him." Proverbs 16:7. "When a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him." It was helpful to me, Dr. Walke points out that this verse is actually the opposite of verse 5. "The prideful are punished, but those who please the Lord are rewarded." And again, verse 6 in the middle is what it looks like to please the Lord. Steadfast love, faithfulness, the fear of the Lord. And as we've learned through further revelation, this can only be done in Christ. Jesus said, "Apart from me, you can do nothing." Proverbs 16:8, the only verse that doesn't have the Lord in it. "Better is a little with righteousness than great revenues with injustice." So this proverb acknowledges a difficult truth. God's justice is frequently delayed. The righteous often have just a little. The unjust often have a lot. It's not saying that having a lot is wrong. Having a lot unjustly is wrong. And that's delayed. That getting sorted out is delayed. But God's justice is ultimately certain. Otherwise, the proverb would be false. Little would never be better. There's no justice, no accountability for how we live, no final judgment, and life is like that old beer commercial. You only go around once in life, so you got to grab for all the gusto you can. But God's justice is indeed certain. Better is a little with righteousness than great revenues with injustice. Imagine the power of this proverb in our valley today. At a business school's first day of classes. In the garage of a startup looking for funding. When a billion-dollar venture has to admit its machines don't work at all, after all. For disruptive technologists who want to flout existing laws. Now, those are easy to list, but imagine the power of this proverb for each one of us when we go to work tomorrow, or whatever God has in front of us. Better is a little with righteousness than great revenues with injustice. Proverbs 16:9. "The heart of man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his steps." Verse 9 brings us full circle back to the beginning of the chapter. And Dr. Walke says one way to translate man throughout this section is as earthling. And I like, when I go to the grocery store and I see the checker, I like to say, "Greetings, earthling." And that usually gets kind of at best a puzzled response back. If they're calling somebody, then I know I've stepped too far. But really, the word here is appropriate. The heart of the earthling plans his way or her way. Earthling reminds us of our mortality. It reminds us of our connection to the dust. It reminds us that plan as we might, the God who raises mortals from the dead is the one who's ultimately in control. He establishes our steps. So let me just say one more time, if you get some time in the near future, spend some time just quietly going through these proverbs and see how God is speaking to you through them. Let me close with this. Our connection to dust made sense to Richard Feynman. The article I referenced earlier mentions that the fact that all things are made of atoms was to him the single most important statement of scientific knowledge. But he also said this in a 1959 television interview that the station ultimately declined to air because of its content. It doesn't seem to me that this fantastically marvelous universe, this tremendous range of time and space, and different kinds of animals, and all the different plants, and all these atoms with their motions and so on, all this complicated thing can merely be a stage so that God can watch human beings struggle for good and evil, which is the view that religion has. The stage is too big for the drama. End quote. For all his brilliance, and Richard Feynman's peers described his thinking as essentially magic, the great physicist could not imagine a God so concerned with human choices. But that is the message of Proverbs this morning. It's the message of Proverbs every morning. God is sovereign, God is just, and he cares what we choose. So by the power of his Spirit, think carefully and choose wisely. Amen.